Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Stella Strega Skaz. She's an Italian scientist who works as an activist for the anti-nuclear campaign in her teens, then for radical feminism, racism and disability awareness in her 20s, before discovering permaculture design and bringing her radical and campaigning spirit into building award-winning, community-run urban permaculture projects during the mid-90s in South London. For the last 15 years, she's lived in the Canary Islands and has focused on mentoring young activists and creating better support systems for change makers, radicalizing the permaculture curriculum, and studying how to design for collective intelligence, better participatory democracy, and effective bioregional and eco-economy systems. She is currently coordinator of the Eighth Life Eco Village Project and the Integral Permaculture Academy. So first, I would like to thank you for your work, and second, I would like to thank you for being on the program.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
So my first question is, what is permaculture as it's often commonly thought of, and then what is your definition of permaculture?
Well, permaculture is basically a design system that aims to design for sustainable human settlements. That's the kind of standard definition. What's happened is that human settlement sounds like the physical stuff, right? So permaculture is mostly known as a kind of, often it's classified as a kind of gardening system, as a sustainability gardening system, more sustainable. It's actually have some, its huge strength has always been regenerating ecosystems and how to accelerate that. Do it effectively. But it's always from the origins been saying that, you know, we have to change social structures within that. It's just that it's gravitated more towards this kind of, most people will think of forest gardens and eco-building and eco-technologies when they think of permaculture.
And so part of, let's talk more about the sort of gardening connection, because honestly, I know for myself that when I think of permaculture, and I think this is true for a fair number of people, like you just said, you know, we think of generally gardens. And I remember years ago, I was talking to somebody about permaculture and how there are people who say that permaculture will save the world. And the person just looked at me and sort of shook their head and said, gardening is supposed to save the world. So can you talk about that common impression and then extend that to talk more about what you were saying about how it's a larger social design system?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think, you know, if we now, I think permaculture was launched in the early 70s, I believe. Obviously, it's got its roots in the 60s. And, well, obviously, it hasn't changed anything. Things have gotten steadily, steadily worse, right? So if permaculture was so revolutionary, we would have noticed, right? But the interesting thing is that from its origins, it never said that it was about gardening. It just became about gardening because that was what caught people's imagination and the kind of people that were attracted to it. But the actual definition of permaculture, the simplest definition is actually a diagram that's in the Permaculture Designer's Manual, which we call the Bible. It's this big, thick book, which is mainly about ecosystems. But the actual definition, it says, is that permaculture design is the beneficial association of four types of components: social, energy components, site and abstract components. Now it's become more these, and this is, this is materialism basically. You know, it's become energy and site components. You know, like the technologies, the structures, the connections, the landscape, all these things. But the social and abstract components were always in there from the beginning in the definition. It's just they weren't, the models of those parts simply were not as developed. Now, there's lots of reasons for this. And one is simply materialism, right? People want to see stuff. They want to build things. But it becomes very obvious when you try to, you know, in any permaculture project, it's not usually the things that fail aren't things like people don't know how to grow carrots or gardens or the forest garden doesn't blossom. It's because people don't get on and groups break down. People get disillusioned. Somebody goes crazy and runs off with the funds, or we can't get funds. So a lot of us, you know, not the majority. I think, you know, your view, what you expressed, is the majority understanding of permaculture. And it's been portrayed that way. In a way, it's been an attempt to depoliticize it. But then from the beginning, also, we've had these in jokes, if you like, of like, you know, permaculture is revolution design disguised as organic gardening. That's like a quote from one of the original teachers. Because there's this revolutionary thing in it, it is about changing society. It's just we've been learning as we go. It's been an action learning process of learning what are the tools, what are all the tools that we need to change society. And there's been an increasing number of us who have been more concerned with adding the other social and abstract or invisible parts of the design process, which are obviously needed. So it's been a path. And then we decided, you know, I spent years going to international conference permaculture to try to change the curriculum. And then we got fed up with this, okay, leave, call it something else, call it integral permaculture, and be done with it. So we don't have to ask permission for anybody, and people just join that or gravitate towards that if they want. And basically, we've created this very, very complete curriculum, which includes all the stuff that most people can't explain. You know, why do people go crazy? Why are people rational 1 minute and irrational the next? You know, are we really doomed, a doomed species because we are inherently egotistical? Any design system that pretends to change society, we'll have to include things like that. We'll have to include answers or models to that and testable ones, right? So we've included all sorts of work from all sorts of pioneers. And it has to be tried and tested stuff. You know, it has to be stuff that's been tested on the ground and seems to work. And it has to be presented and treated as a science in the sense that it's an iterative process. We have to test these things. We have to see if they actually work on the ground. If they don't, if somebody has a better model, we try that. Does that answer your question?
I didn't go enough yet. I think I don't want to belabor this point, but I want to go through this just one more time, because I've had pretty interesting experiences myself with permaculture in terms of audience response to my work, in that I've gotten some very nice notes from some of the people who have done a lot of really great theoretical work around permaculture, and some of the people who have done very good on the ground work with permaculture. And we've had some nice exchanges, some of us, and that's all really nice. And then there have been some I guess what I'm trying to get at is that, do you want to talk for just a moment about the way that movements sometimes get depoliticized, such that there have been some very strident people within permaculture who have gotten very upset when I talk about organized political resistance as opposed to organic gardening. And once again, I guess one reason I'm asking this is because there's always been this sort of split in my head that I've gotten some really nice notes from, like I say, from a lot of very serious permaculture people, and there's been some people around the edges of it who have been very upset at the notion of organized resistance. Is this making sense?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I get that all the time. I mean, we know, and it's more like, you know, permaculture isn't a homogeneous movement. It attracts all kinds of people, and it attracts a lot of people who are in this phase of, okay, I can see the world's going to pot. You know, this kind of panic, like, oh God, what do I do? And then there's this easy entry, say, wait, garden, you know, set up a garden. There's actually people who are saying, you know, the solution to the world's problem lie in the garden. And that's very comforting for a lot of people. And it's kind of fine, to be at that stage as well. And see, these are emotional responses, you know, when people get strident and they get angry and they get, you know, furious at you. I mean, I know what you mean, because I recently defended you in a thread in Facebook that, you know, somebody actually dared to bring this. It was a lecture that you did saying, you know, look around, you know, what do we ever talk about this elephant in the room, you know, that we're destroying all the ecosystems and everything. And in, within permaculture, we don't. We talk about building, you know, we talk about, we overquote, you know, this quote about, you know, Buckminster Fuller's quote about working on the solution and then, you know, the problems will go away. Which is very naive on one hand, right? And but it makes sense for a certain phase of development. See, that's the other thing. If you have models that explain how people go through stages, then you can say, okay, that person is at that stage and that person is another stage. So, and the other thing is what you're saying, you know, getting strident. You know, we need also, like, how to explain how people get irrational. You know, like we have in the language, you know, you push people's buttons. I mean, your work pushes people's buttons, right? You know that. and I find that fascinating. That's why, and I think we've incorporated all that. It's like, okay, what is this pushing buttons? What does it actually mechanically do? And how do you counter it? So, yeah, I would say that, you know, we need to solve that problem. You know, when one is the homogeneity, never expect people to be a homogeneous bunch. But that's just the history of who is attracted to permaculture. There are a lot of people who, you know, permaculture is very attractive because it's so solution oriented, because it's so practical, because you can get your hands dirty and do something. And in a way that can be an escapism, right? But it's fine to be there too, because when, you know, I went through that phase too. You know, I was a social activist and I got burnt out in my 20s, you know, with the despondency of it all, with that, how huge it seemed. And permaculture was really attractive as saying, hey, let's just build the next culture. You know, fuck this one. You know, just build the next one. And it's got brilliant tools to do that. And then, you know, later I realized, okay, we have to do both, actually. You know, we have to bring down the old one and bring up the new one at the same time. It's not one or the other. It's not one or before or after. This has to happen at the same time. It is happening at the same time. We just need the tools to accelerate that, to get it to go in the right direction, basically. So, yeah, I mean, I get stridents at, you know, shouting at me often as well because of the ideas we put out. And I think that's good. I think it's great to get people moving emotionally. I think it's great to provoke people. I think, but then we have to create the forums, you know, the places where people can just let out all this energy and this emotion so they can think. And debating, I'm not sure. I'm experimenting with that. Like, you know, when you debate, you're a writer, right? So there's a lot of debate in writing now, you know, in Facebook and in forums and articles that come with, you know, you can give your opinion afterwards, which is great. I think they're amazing experiments in, you know, participatory democracy in a way, and very, very hopeful. And then you get just a huge mixed bag, right? You always get a troll, you know, somebody who goes off the top of their head like crazy with emotion or something. And then you get the rational people and you get some interesting arguments. And I just think it's part of the process. So
you recently wrote an article for Permaculture Design magazine. You and your co-author. Jose. I'm sorry?
Jose Zamora. Mm-hmm.
And one of the things you talk about, let's go to the root of permaculture. And, you know, usually we think of permaculture, just one word, which once again means gardening or forest gardening or something like that to a lot of people. But break it down to permaculture, and then, as you do in the article, and then also you say that, here's a quote from it. In the article, we mentioned a few of the cultural patterns we noticed we carry as colonialist people. There are many, but one way of describing several of them in terms of how we think and act in the world is that a root colonialist attitude, whereas a non-colonialist or indigenous attitude would be, you contrast those. Can you talk about that for a minute?
Yeah, it's just the different story behind our cultures, right? And we can't lump all indigenous cultures in one, but, you know, because they're very different, that's the whole point. You know, they're very, very adapted to their own ecosystem. And but there are patterns that we notice. And one is, you know, the earth belongs to us versus we belong to the earth. And it comes together with, you know, being, we are part of the whole. An indigenous mentality would more like, we're just a cell in this massive ecosystem, which is Gaia. And, or, you know, the other one is man is here to dominate nature and to extract resources. So it's an extraction versus relationship. And this is all dualisms, but it's significant because they're just very different stories. They're diametrically opposite stories. And the myths, and I mean, permaculture originally comes from permanent agriculture, but it was very quickly, I think within, you know, a few years of having these, becoming a movement, you know, in the sense that they started meeting internationally, they actually changed it very quickly to permanent culture, because it's, you know, it's not just about agriculture. And in fact, and later, and I don't know how this was already in the origins, but, you know, we certainly have an understanding now, or more of an understanding, that agriculture in itself can't be sustainable. Although there's a lot of people lagging behind in permaculture, because, as I said, you know, permaculture is very, very diverse, and there's a lot of new people that come in with very old ideas, and it takes a while for even the best or the most radical in permaculture to get to them. But basically, you know, it in terms of like, and also permaculture from the origins has always looked to native cultures for understanding, in the sense of, for example, our ethics come from there. It was actually a research into, okay, look at sustainable societies, sustainable human societies. What ethics do they have? What rules do they have? And I think it was Bill Mollison, or maybe it took from others' work. I actually don't know the details. But, you know, they came up with lots of things that they seem to have in common, like, you know, 20 rules. And they compressed them down into three. And so these are the ethics of permaculture. People care, earth care. It's got usually done in this order, earth care, people care. And the third one was actually originally putting limits to population and consumption. That's what's in the manual. But that got diluted very, very quickly into fair shares. And you can guess why. And see, that's the thing, you know, movements and even sciences, you know, even things that are very radical at the beginning get diluted with time.
So you said we can guess why, but go ahead and be, I think it never hurts to be completely explicit.
Right, but it's because it's provocative, right? Because it hits right at the root of the ethics of our culture. And in fact, I was actually taught this in my first permaculture course. You know, the ethics are there because they are, and they're explicit in permaculture because the ethics of our culture, and we call it the destructor culture to contrast it to the permaculture. So that's great about permaculture. It gives you all this funny language that you actually make sense of the world. And so in the destructor culture, we still have ethics. They're just not explicit because they can't be. And the non-explicit ethics of destructor culture are exactly the opposite. So instead of people care, it's exploit people, use people, extract from people. Instead of earth care is trash the earth, exploit the earth, use the earth. And the economic core is grow, right? Is grow, you know, keep consuming. And so the contrasting ethic in permaculture was, it still is for some of us, because some of us have held on to that, even though it's not popular. That's the thing. It tried to popularize itself. And this ethic, putting limits to population and consumption, which is in some form, it's in all indigenous cultures, in all sustainable human cultures, they have this. Stay within the limits, keep your population and consumption within the limits of the ecosystem, right? Otherwise, they wouldn't have survived till now.
I know, that's pretty much the definition of sustainable.
Exactly.
For non-humans too, it doesn't matter for whom.
Exactly. But that got changed, and it got diluted into fair shares, which sounds a lot more hippie, right? More kind of friendly, and doesn't mean anything, because you can exploit the earth and then, oh yeah, let's keep robbing and growing, but share it more fairly, whatever that means. I mean, at root, it means share fairly amongst all species. But, you know, we're totally anthropocentric people. who's going to remember that? So that's why the most explicit ethic, the original one, you know, put limits to population and consumption, it is basically, yeah, it triggers people, right? It annoys people. It sounds unfriendly. It sounds terrible. It sounds like, oh, you're telling me how many children I must have. Or, you know, I already don't consume that much. Why are you telling me not to consume? But ethics are there to guide us. Now there's people who said, well, they've changed it, because also it was very long and wieldy. So some people, and I kind of agree with that. It's, you know, care of earth, care of people, care of the future. It's more in line. But I like to, you know, I think it is our job to provoke people to think and to wake people, you know, to wake people up of the dream of this consumer culture that's killing itself as completely death loving. You're going to upset a few people. I think it's fine. But yeah, that's one of the things that happened. And in all movements, this, if movements are very effective, the system will do something about it. You know, the system, I mean, what's great about having an understanding of ecology is there's a lot of models that you can apply to any living system. And society, culture is a living system. And there's a principle of homeostasis that any organism will try to keep its own equilibrium. And that's why our bodies have defense mechanisms, yeah? We, you know, if any microbes come in, you know, we have this whole stuff that gets triggered off and we fight them off. Well, the destructive culture has...
Or if I get hot, I sweat. I mean, that would be homeostasis.
Yeah, you keep to the range that your system needs to survive. Now, of course, Lovelock came out with this wonderful theory of Gaia as a whole system, and that's been in the ether for a long time. And that's very much a kind of native-like mentality of how to think of the whole earth as an organism. But the destructive culture, you know, capitalism, the world as we know it now, the multinational conglomerate, whatever you want to call it, has its own homeostasis. It has its own defense systems. If we don't understand those defense systems, we haven't got a hope in hell. And one of them is, you know, anything that works, you co-opt it, yeah? And you ridicule it, you put it down, you make it unpopular in some way, yeah, by triggering people. It very much uses our mental construct, our distress patterns to trigger us. And you've seen how well it works with DGR. It was wonderful to see just how provocative that was. I mean, wonderful in one sense, because it's like, that's actually what attracted me to DGR in a sense. Was like, I actually was told this by a permaculture tutor of mine, a senior guy who, you know, had lots more experience than me. And I went to him in distress one day, because while I was out of the country, some people were boycotting the project that Left Behind. And I was like amazed. I said, what's going on? And, you know, he heard the story. I said, oh, don't worry. Whenever you see somebody doing anything that threatens the system, you'll see fireworks. Something will happen, you know. And so he said, you know, he learned to, like, you know, wherever he sees these fireworks, he looks there because there must be something interesting going on. And he said, it basically told me about horizontal hostility. You know, if you do really significant work in the world, you will be attacked. And prepare for it. You know, set up good support systems. Don't be, you know, destroyed by it. And see, all of that to me is permaculture. Okay, how do we design? It's not difficult to design a utopia. Anybody can do that. You sit down with a book and and we've got lots of utopias designed. What is difficult is designing the transition to that, right? That's what we're doing. That's where design which is strategizing, you know, we call it design, but it's, and what I love about permaculture, because, you know, it took from design sciences of all kinds, you know, from engineering, from graphic design, from everything, you know, from management, all the tools that make us better thinkers, better strategizers, better planners. The difficult thing, the huge challenge is how do we design? Well, it's quite a challenge to design. I think we need a planetary culture. That's what's trying to be born, I think. And the globalizing economy is attractive because it does that. It gives us this, you know, this kind of humanity can talk to itself across the globe type thing. I think we need to, and I contrast planetary to globalization. You know, one is the global villages, and the other one is the global village. You know, the Coca-Cola everywhere, English spoken everywhere. And the other one is this diverse, you know, global villages where it's multicultural, it's, you know, totally adapted to ecosystem, totally sustainable villages and stuff. But we still need to design how do we keep in touch so that if there is a future, right? It doesn't happen again, so that capitalism doesn't happen again, so that somebody doesn't, you know, break their boundaries and start killing and killing sustainable cultures, right? We need a kind of global consciousness, and that's where we're at this time where we could design that if we're clever enough, if we're quick enough, and how. And so there's a lot of us thinking about this. Some of us are called integral permaculture designers. Some of us are called permaculture designers. Some of us call ourselves completely something else. The point is that we're all trying to figure out, okay, how do we stop this destruction as quickly as possible and get on to our chosen utopia, or whatever we think this should look like.
So what is the... what is the relationship? How do you, I love the root of the word education. Education comes from the root educara, which means to lead forth or draw out. And originally it was a Greek midwife's term, meaning to be present at the birth of. And so how do you educate, how do you integrate educating people about these and the tangible work that people often think of when they think of permaculture, the sort of gardening, or you talk. I mean, you are in an eco village. So how do you combine what you're talking about on these larger philosophical levels and doing the dishes or eating or disposing of your poop or whatever it is that you're doing in your community?
Well, it's totally interconnected, and that's what's exciting about doing it, that you can't do it without drawing out, literally. I mean, one of the things we say at the beginning when anybody comes into wants to learn permaculture is we have a lot of things to unlearn. You know, there's a lot of shit in here, which is just old garbage that needs to come out during installing the new program, if you like, you know. So the actual process of living, I mean, one of the things that's been fascinating for me, and that's why one of the things I dedicated a lot of time to was actually how to teach permaculture in a more effective way. And we know that people learn by doing, you know, people learn by playing. Children show us, you know, you experiment, you play around, you know, you try things over and over again, you have fun. It's usually in groups with other people. And it's a scientific process of trying, you know, you get an idea of something, you test it, and then you rearrange your theory. So one is that we put action learning right at the center. And that's learning from nature, which is one of, you know, permaculture's rules. You look at nature, you know, and there's this, again, this is a very native-like mentality, is nature is the perfect design. Nature has the perfect design. We've messed up because we haven't understood it. So it's always learn from nature. And children, babies, show us what human nature is more than an adult who's been already socialized, right? And that's kind of... So, you know, we look at children, how they learn, and, you know, children just get on with things. You know, they try things out, and then they want to experiment and communicate with other people to see, you know. When you put people in this kind of, and in fact, we only started doing an eco-village recently. Before this, I was very clear that we needed a test site. We needed a place where people could actually come and design, because often people go and do courses, very short courses. So one of the things I wanted to do was much longer experiences, because it's such an internal process that needs to happen. You have to vomit out some crap from our culture, right, from the disruptor culture. And that takes some kind of holding, and it takes time. So we developed these kind of longer experiences, but also we knew that people need to design real things, you know, things that aren't there, not just go and do some practical, in inverted commas, like, you know, build somebody's compost toilet, which has already been designed. They're just putting the wood together or whatever. That's not practical in the sense that we mean. But it's people crave this in our society, you know, that we want to just do something with our hands because, you know, the academic system has brutalized that so much. And, you know, sitting at a desk for like 8 hours a day or whatever, people come out of it just screaming for doing stuff. And sadly forget that the theory is actually important, or they don't want to know about more theory, right? So we have to do both. And it's amazing when you put people in a kind of healthier setting, in a more rural setting, in a more closer to nature setting, this stuff just comes up. And it comes up differently for different people. You know, some people will like, you know, everybody says, oh, I want to come because I want to live close to nature and I want to da da da. And this close to nature thing is very prominent. And then they find out, oh my God, they're scared of rats, you know, or lizards really get to them, or they can't stand the flies. You know, they will, that's nature, honey. You know, what do we need to do to deal with it? And often it's an emotional process. You know, it comes back to trauma that happened, not just personally, this is cultural trauma, you know, that shit is disgusting, putrefaction is the end of the world, and death is totally associated with violence or with something completely disgusting. There's lots of stories within the destructor culture story that have to be unraveled, and they have to become conscious. You know, as they come out, as they get questioned, they unravel. And then we can think and we can say, okay, wow, that doesn't make any sense. But it's an emotional process. We have to hold that. And that's how people, I've seen people learn. I've seen people make amazing, I mean, I've made amazing transformations, you know. And I, my job, I see it as helping people make those transformations faster. Because I spent my 20s in massive depressions because I didn't understand these things. And now I see people in their 20s getting it really fast. And it just gives me hope, you know. And it can be done. But we need those structures. You know, people in our culture, you know, you can't expect people to become intelligent activists who know how to bring down this culture and build a new one when all they've had is an educational system that totally brutalizes the human soul. We need to have recovery places for that. We need to avoid those things happening, of course, if we can. But the reality is most people will come through that. So things like, you know, trying to like creating alternatives to university, for example, so that people who do want to keep learning and they haven't brutalized to the point that they stop learning, that they're not interested in education, they have actual alternatives. But also encouraging people to not think of education, the standard education, as the end all and be all. Basically catching people as early as possible, because we can work. In my experience, I've worked much more effectively with the younger the people, the quicker they get this.
Well, that reminds me of one of the stories that I thought was really interesting in your recent article, which was about you were, let me find this, in London, there were several interconnected projects happening. One was making organic vegetables affordable to low-income people in inner-city neighborhoods. And then you were I'm looking about where the – where was the thing about there were children who helped design one of the projects Then they got overruled by. Go ahead, take over.
The forest garden. There's two types of forest garden, two stories of two forest gardens. Well, Green Adventure, which is the organization I set up immediately after doing my permaculture course, I just went out there and thought, I have to do this. Because I was a play worker, I worked with young people for 15 years before that. We naturally, and my partner that started it with me was also into young, you know, working with young people. So we naturally worked with young people. We had this piece of land that was given to us by the council because we just asked nicely and we quoted local agenda 21. We didn't think there'd be any problem. There wasn't. And they were very nice about it. And we just started by putting, you know, getting a bunch of fruit trees one Sunday and face paints. And, you know, because it's near some housing estates with very poor people, you know, piled up in these horrible flats. And it's the only piece of green. We just asked passing people if they wanted to plant trees. And the children, mostly they were children, and we just said, do you want to plant a tree? Choose one. And we let them design it because we know that people need to have ownership, right? They need to have – we love designing. And one of the errors that we do as permaculture designers is we design things for people and then we get upset that they don't feel that they don't maintain them. Well, people don't maintain things that other people have done. We're so alienated from our own creativity, and we were so bored with doing other people's projects that so we knew that, and we also didn't know how to design. It was just a flat piece of land, and it didn't make much difference. So when children would ask us, "Where do I put it?" with you know, the thing would occur to us to say, "Ask the tree." And children don't have any problem with this. Okay, they're like, "Think of it," and they will think. I want to put it there. And so they planted these trees. And this was in a very high crime area, the highest crime rate, the lowest poverty rate in London, or I think in the country, possibly. We never got any vandalism. Okay, this forest garden thrived for a long time. The biggest problem it had was rubbish because it was on the way, you know, in a passing way, and people would just throw rubbish over the fence. And so we'd have these cleanups with the children and have, like that's actually how they started a local led scheme for children. We got them to have competition with themselves, how many people, I think it was pecks they could earn in summer by bringing in bags of rubbish from there, and then we'd give them something in exchange. But another forest garden, which I did much later, and this was in near Madrid. I did the same kind of, you know, I was called in as a consultant, you know, to help set up this forest garden. And they wanted me to do it with the school. So I did the same kind of thing. We had this piece of land and I taught children a bit about design, you know, about a base map. You know, we created a base map. We did wild design, which is another design technique where you just go crazy and you just don't have any limits and you just do whatever comes out. And we did these beautiful drawings with colors on these big pieces of cardboard. Then the parents and the people who actually asked me to do this completely ignored the children's drawings. They didn't follow through on that vein and actually listened to what they're doing. And they started designing themselves. And then they were surprised that, you know, trees were getting stolen. And this was in a very well-to-do area. That was funny as well. You know, so the contrast is huge. And what we have, and this is just a story to illustrate other things that happened. We were, Green Adventure was imitated a lot very quickly. Lots of people would like, an organization would say, hey, that works, you know, we want to do it here. In fact, one of the original ones that I remember some colleagues, in fact, there were permaculture colleagues from another part of London, of South London. When they heard that we got this land really quickly and really easily, they phoned us and said, hey, how did you get that? We've been fighting for years for the council to give us land. And I thought, well, we didn't fight. We just helped them. You know, we approached them as, we're going to help you. You've got this LA 21, Local Agenda 21 work to do. we're doing exactly the same thing. You're supposed to support us, and we're giving you a chance here. So we approached them as helpers, and they approached them as enemies. So, yeah, okay, if you set it up like that, you're not likely to get very far. But the other attitude is, you know, let people design their own thing. But this all comes from a radical perspective. See, we were feminists. The people who started this, a nucleus of us were women, and we were very close friends, and we were radicals. And we have an idea of oppression, how oppression operates. And that changed everything. It changed how it was the core of why we were so, it was so possible for us to attract a very wide cross-section. You know, we had all sexualities, all ages, all races, all everything in there, all classes. And it's because we designed it that way. It didn't happen by chance. It's all designed. It's all conscious. And people who tried to imitate that got the form and not the function. Okay, which is like a core of design, is you design from functions, not from form. And what happens also with permaculture, that's why it got diluted so much, is that people, we tend to copy things as the form. You know, we say, oh, that's nice, I want to do a forest garden too, clomp. And it's like a stamp, you know, a repetitive stamp thing. Instead of designing, designing is exactly the opposite. Designing has to be totally principle-based, totally adapted to the social and reality of the place you're in. You have to observe really well. You have to get all these elements together and really think, what's the best strategy here? What's the best next step? What's the vision? And get the vision together from lots of people, if you know, if you're working with lots of people. So there's a lot of stuff involved. And the root of this is we don't actually teach design properly. We even permaculture design, we're teaching people to copy. Even as we say it's design, it's not, the education of it isn't strong enough for people to actually come out and understand this. But that's also because we'd never teach this, how oppression is designed, which we've had to incorporate. And this whole process, see, I was doing this stuff with my friends very naturally because I was an activist before becoming a permaculture designer. But the process of then failing, because we had lots of failures afterwards, or seeing other people fail mainly, because we already set up, you know, we already had this group, was actually, you know, there's this process where you don't know what you know, and then you know what you know. So it was learning, why did we do that? And we did it consciously, but not, you know, not so intentionally. It was just natural for us to think of oppressed people, to think of internalized oppression, to think of exclusion, to know about inclusion and how it works. But it was like the water we swim in for us. We knew that, but we could only understand that we needed to teach that to others in the context of seeing people copy and fail. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, it does. Thank you for that. And we have about 5 minutes left, and I'm wondering, we've covered a lot of ground, talked about so many different topics, and I'm wondering, how can somebody who is listening to this in Nova Scotia, what do you want them to do? What do you want people to take away from this interview and then do in their own lives and or in their communities and in their natural communities, you know, including their non-human inhabitants? What do you, I mean, you basically have given people a huge meal here, and what do you want them to do with this huge meal?
Okay. Well, we've actually taken a long, long time to break it down into little bits and figured out how to help people. It, you know, action learning is you do what's in front of your nose that you are interested in. You know, where your passion is taking you, whatever you're interested in, and you can feel from inside this is you love doing. You do that. That's your next step. That's simplifying a lot. Something that we actually teach how to design your life, and it's a process. So We have this, we've created an integral permaculture designer's manual online, and it's free, and it's multimedia, and it's huge, but it's in sections. So it's an actual self-learning tool that you can go to, and it's permaculturescience.org. It's in Spanish and English. And it's divided into five modules. So there's people care, earth care, design techniques, eco-economy, and technology and energy. So whatever of those topics that cover everything, we think, in terms of like how to create a new world, how to design sustainable society, we think everything's in there. If you see something that's not in there, we want to hear from you, okay? It's a participatory manual. We're actually working in teams, and people suggest things. But that's a kind of place that you can pick. And we've picked the best stuff, and the stuff that's coherent with each other. That's the other thing. There's a lot of incoherent stuff out there that just doesn't fit. You know, our heads are full of stuff that just doesn't work together. All of this does. So permaculturescience.org is a good place to look at if you want to get inspiration. But it's getting in touch with other people doing this kind of work. You know, finding one of the things that in terms of designing your life is designing the community around you, the people who, and we design that consciously or unconsciously, we're designing it. So might as well design it consciously. Surround yourself with the kinds of people that are doing the work you love to see more of, and surround yourself with the kind of people that have the interests of the planet in mind, you know, who are doing inspiring work for you. Just have to be around them. That doesn't mean to be physically, you know. What's nice about internet is you have to be mentally around their ways of thinking and drench yourself in that. So spend time with inspiring people, whether you read them, listen to them, there's lots of audios now, and do stuff in your community if you can, you know, whatever's there. There's always something there that needs doing, and there's always amazing people around if you look for that. Is that small enough bite?
And that's really great. Thank you so much. And I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Stella Strega-Skaz. This is Derek Denson for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.